Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest this week is Emily M. Danforth, author of Plain Bad Heroines, the eagerly anticipated follow-up to her award-winning 2012 YA novel, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. That's a lesbian coming-of-age story set in the author's home state of Montana. Danforth now makes her home in Rhode Island, where the bulk of Plain Bad Heroines is set. The story goes a little something like this. In 1902, two students at an all-girls boarding school meet a most gruesome fate in the campus woods. Found at the scene is a copy of a book that may or may not have something to do with their demise. In fact, it may be cursed. Fast forward to present-day Los Angeles, where a movie about the two girls, the book, and the seemingly cursed boarding school is in the works, starring an it girl from Montana, potentially co-starring the actor daughter of a classic scream queen, and based on a true crime style, kind of Truman Capote style book about the cursed boarding school, written by a literary wunderkind. This enthusiastically queer novel, illustrated by Sarah Lautman, is strange, spooky, and 600 pages long. In other words, an absolutely perfect way to spend Halloween weekend if you're not up for trick-or-treating for whatever reason. Bonus, several early readers have suggested on social media that this book, about a movie about a book, may or may not be cursed. Or at least strange things have been happening to them while they've been reading it. This truly delectable melange of fact and fiction, parody and pomology, horror and hymenopterans, yes, I went there, will delight readers of all stripes, if it doesn't kill them first. Too much? Danforth has an MFA in fiction from the University of Montana and a PhD in English, creative writing from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. As said, she lives in Rhode Island with her wife, her mother, and by her own admission on her website, quote, two of the most spoiled dogs on the planet. She'll join us soon, but first, a word from our sponsor, Abrams Books for Young Readers, regarding a new picture book you and your kids are going to love. In the mood for a good book? Then you'll be over the moon for Moo Moo, I Love You, from New York Times bestselling picture book creators Tom Lichtenheld and Amy Krauss Rosenthal. Moo Moo, I Love You is a moving ode to the love between caregiver and child. Readers will love the utterly creative wordplay with each heartfelt expression between the cow and calf. I love giving you a big smooch. My love for you is as big as a moose, with a universal message and warm, funny text that families will read and reread together. This is an exuberant book for those you love, no matter their mood. Find out more about Moo Moo, I Love You at abramsbooks.com. After the break, I'll be talking with Emily M. Danforth, author of Plain Bad Heroines.
Author Mark John Terranova's novel, Gemini Ascending, Tempting Eternity, reckons with chaotic worlds. He envisioned this book as a modern-day Game of Thrones with a strong current social message. Kirkus Reviews' verdict? Get it. Our reviewer calls it a captivating, otherworldly sequel and says the story triumphantly fuses fantasy with real-world relationships. You can find Gemini Ascending online at Amazon, Walmart, Apple, and Barnes & Noble in ebook, paperback, and hardcover.
Welcome, Emily, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
On account of you, a lot of things have changed in my life since I read this book. First of all, I fear I may be cursed. I don't know. Also, I now answer my phone, I await the devil's coming.
Well, I thought you were already doing that.
No, it's new.
You are not the first reader to tell me that they think they're cursed. Are you having strange incidents with yellow jackets or wasps? Is that why you think you're cursed?
Well, you know, it's hard for me. I went to the Terminix website to try to deduce what the difference is between yellow jackets, wasps, and hornets and bees. And okay. I actually came away more confused. Mm-hmm. Could you help me with that? You know, like,
no. I mean, I could if we were looking at a bee. I think that's certainly one. But the other three, no. I mean, things get pretty. That is, no. Maybe if it was a ground nest, as opposed. This is getting very deep in the woods, and no one cares. But I will tell you, like, in terms of being cursed, I am hearing that. I'm hearing, you know, I guess the book is just releasing at the right time because yellow jacket colonies are more active this time of year. It's that kind of like last gasp before most of them will die. And so they're out anyway. And I think a lot of readers, I mean, one reader told me she was chased through the bookstore by one. Another reader told me that his grill had a nest in them. They kind of conquered the nest and or the grill, and he's not going to use it anymore. So I don't know. I didn't think that would all be attributed to my book, but I say keep those stories coming because they're delighting me.
This is probably the point in our story where I ask you, what is this book about?
Oh, no. I thought you were going to tell me, Megan.
I could. If you want it, I will give it.
I would love. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yes, please.
Okay.
Please tell me what it's about.
Okay. Plain Bad Heroines is a great big novel that kind of occurs in two times, right? There's early, very early 20th century Rhode Island, specifically Little Compton, specifically at a school for girls that seems to be operating under a deadly curse, potentially related to a controversial memoir written in 1901 or two or one.
Wow.
Okay. And the other narrative line here, it takes place in the 21st century in Los Angeles, but also in Rhode Island. And it's kind of like the making of a movie kind that involves the controversial memoir. It's tricky and it's sticky for me, Emily,
right? Yeah,
because I don't want to give away the wrong information.
Mm, that's fair. That's fair. I did put you on the spot. You asked me to do it. Who wants to do an elevator pitch ever? And it was wonderful that you did that for me. But no, that is, I think, the most succinct way to describe the book is to kind of divide it into those two halves. And some people will quibble with me and say, well, but the historic portion really has a deeper half because then you get the history of the women that founded the boarding school. But I still think for these purposes, yes, there's a contemporary storyline of the making of the controversial queer film. And then there's the historic storyline of the cursed boarding school.
Okay, cool. So like pursuant to the cursed boarding school and the controversial memoir I mentioned, who was Mary McLean?
Oh, she was amazing. She was a teen writer, wrote a memoir. She called it her portrayal. At 19, living in Butte, Montana, you know, set out to write this book with the hopes that it would do exactly what it did, which was lift her out of her dull domestic life and into really, for the day, literary superstardom. I should mention that she obviously wouldn't have used this term to describe herself, but bisexual woman writer, and again, from Montana, which is my home state. And yeah, her memoir was published by a Chicago publisher. She, under the name The Story of Mary McLean, in 1902, and instant sort of sensation, 80,000 copies sold in the first month alone, and, you know, came under much sort of scorn and derision, but also inspired things like teenage girl fan clubs. You know, there was a young woman arrested for stealing a horse in Chicago, and she said she did it because she had to have something to write about, like Mary McLean. And so, you know, like that's what she said in front of the judge, you know, and then of course the newspaper sort of paints this portrait of her mother wringing her hands and shaking her head, you know, behind her. It was wonderful. And I mean, she was such a literary sensation for several months after that she really was kind of hounded by the press. I mean, she sold her likeness to a cigar manufacturer. There were cocktails named after her. You can't really overstate how big a deal she was. But also, I should say that the book is just a delight. It's a delight to read in 2020. And I learned a little bit about her, not a ton before I read it. And I wasn't prepared just for how much I would love her voice and her candor and her wit. I just think it's really, really fun. And I would recommend it heartily to anyone who feels even the slightest inkling of picking it up after reading Plain Bad Heroines. So.
And her her intended title for the memoir?
Oh, was not I the await title the devil's under. Coming. I await the
there
devil's
you
coming.
Go.
Absolutely. Your phone message, yes.
I also read that in addition to the cocktail and the cigars and the clubs, a Tabasco sauce.
Oh, I didn't know that one. That one I did not know.
I mean, you're going to have to check my work because, like, obviously I'm not half the researcher you are, but...
No, I'm sure you're right. I mean, one of the things that was so fun about Mary MacLean is that she got so much press. Like, Michael Brown is one of the historians that's collected a lot of it into a number of volumes. Mary MacLean and the Humorous, you know, all the sort of satirical work that was sort of an homage to her. But also you can use a subscription to newspapers.com and just spend hours, as I have, reading the press that Mary MacLean got. You know, some of it really delightful and some of it I'm sure she preferred not to have gotten. So, yeah.
Well, I just may do that after our conversation.
It's a good time.
So your novel, this memoir kind of winds up. The first thing we learn is that it's kind of associated with the untimely demise of two girls who were students at the Brookhaun School for Girls mm-hmm. in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Where do we want to go with that? Do you want to talk about the school? Do you want to talk about the girls? Do you want to-
The school is entirely of my invention, although mm-hmm. Some of the locations in Rhode Island are born from places I've visited or fictionalized versions of places here in Rhode Island. Obviously, there's a long history of the sapphic boarding school novel or the queer boarding school novel. Those of us who haven't been, right, and grew up in rural Midwestern hometowns, I think romanticize them in ways
sure.
that we learn is completely inappropriate and ridiculous as adults, but it's there. And I didn't, you know, I knew I wasn't going to write a contemporary boarding school novel, but what I will say about Brookhaun's is part of the research that intoxicated me so much was just learning more about the era of romantic friendships as it pertained to women's colleges and boarding schools, and thinking about this kind of sanctioning of these like deeply romantic and certainly sometimes sexual relationships between women. And, you know, I was able to come across letters that students wrote home to their mothers, right? Talking very openly about their crushes on other students. And in one case, the mother wrote back and said, "This is wonderful. This is a lot like a crush that I had 20 years ago." And yeah, all of that was just really so inspiring and delightful to me. I wanted to get to put it in scene, which is where a lot of that historic portion came from.
This is certainly delightful and inspiring, because those are the kinds of connections that are often, if not like outright burned, the letters, right?
Yeah.
They're kind of like lost to history, undocumented or relegated to the footnotes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're coded or subdued, or there's always someone like raising their hand saying, "Well, you can't really know," right? And it's like, mm-hmm. "I really can know." But we don't have, you know, an signed affidavit, a notarized statement. And so, yeah, I wanted to let these many women at this boarding school have their queer relationships on the page with no question that's what they're doing. So, yeah.
Speaking of we can't really know, it's very interesting because the untimely demise of the girls I mentioned, Flo and Clara, nobody seems to really – they know that they expired, but they don't really – understand all of the circumstances surrounding their deaths. And like, there's kind of in the beginning of the book, it's like, some people say this, yeah. others say that, you know, and it kind of almost like was borderline sapphic. Are you recognizing that famous like fragment? It's like, some say a host of horsemen is the most beautiful thing on the black earth. Some say it's this, but I, Sappho, say it's what everyone
loves.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that crept up, right? From like my lesbian bloodstream without me even realizing that's what happened. That's how it works.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you're not quite pinning down desire, but that almost makes it more delicious, I'd say.
Yeah, and I think that, like, certainly in terms of sapphic portrayals, but I'm thinking just that's one of the things that I love, and I know so many fans of horror and horror writers love, is that ambiguity of what, you know, what is actually happening, what's imagined, right? Like, how... what exactly are the stakes here and the circumstances? And I always love that in horror stories, and it's definitely something that I think the novel is playing with. What's actually going on here and what's invented or imagined.
Right. So would you give us a little bit more of what's going on about 100 years, give or take, after
sure, so
their death?
100 years, give or take, after their death. Okay, I'm kind of getting the right storyline. One of the three women that we focus on in that portion of the novel is the sort of Wunderkind writer who wrote this story about Brokance. And she's been asked to consult on the making of the film that involves the other two characters, one of whom is kind of a rising star of indie film, book, you know, winkingly, I think knowingly calls her a Selesbian, and she sort of owns that title. That actually was the original title that I sold the book under, was Selesbian.
Really?
Yeah, a long time ago when it was going to be a YA book that only told the contemporary storyline. So interrupting myself. But yeah, it was a very, very different book.
How intriguing.
Yeah, I don't know if it is, but I'll go with you. I couldn't write that book. The thing that I told you happened, which is I got really pretty obsessed with the historic portion. And I was researching that initially just to answer for myself the question of why is, I've got this great location, they're going to film a horror movie there, why is the school abandoned? And then in trying to answer that question, I did more and more research. And at some point, it just became really clear to me, I don't want this research to just be, you know, background information informing me as a novelist. I think it's part of the novel. I want to see these characters in scene. And this was after these many failed attempts of trying to stuff it into, you know, letters or journal entries, these other kinds of things, and it just wasn't working. And that was a total, you know, revisioning of the novel. It really was. And so that's like a years long process. I'm whittling it down here, but I got real stuck for a while, and then I had to sort of let myself write the book as it is. So at any rate, so one of the other contemporary characters is an actress, Harper Harper. And then the third is a B-list actress, Audrey, with a cult horror film lineage. Her mom was a famous 80s slasher star. And yeah, these three women wind up together involved in the making of the horror movie about the curse at Brokance.
Right. Really random question, sidebar. Am I hallucinating, or are there certain proper nouns in this book that are slightly darker than the rest of the text?
The names of the character, I'm like, what is in the what's going on? What are they? Yeah. What are, the designer was brilliant. So the names of the characters are, you're not hallucinating. Yeah, okay. The POV characters at the beginning of the, you're like, just how much of House of Leaves are you? No, the POV characters at the beginning of each chapter are bolded. But it's
thank God.
Yeah, yes, you are not hallucinating. Okay. Although you threw me off for a minute. I'm like, what's happening in the pages of this book that I don't know about? It's possible.
Okay, well, since we're already here, let's take a spin around this cul-de-sac and talk about the illustrations by Sarah Lottman. Could you tell me a little bit about how they came to be?
Sure. Sarah contacted me. She'd read my first novel, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, and was a fan, and just said, if you ever want to write a short story or an essay, something short is what she was proposing together, let me know. And I said, that's so great. I'm working on this novel right now. I don't really have anything. And maybe a year passed, and I was finally making some headway with the book, and I thought, this is what should be illustrated. I mean, this is, you know, we know about the illustrated 19th century novel. It certainly fits with some of the things I was looking at in terms of Gothic lit and Victorian lit. And beyond that, there's such a history of the illustrated boarding school novel. So I wrote Sarah back and I said, would you have any interest in doing this much larger project? And she luckily was really interested and had all kinds of ideas. So we were working together pretty early, and it was very new for both of us. She had not ever worked, you know, with a novelist on something, a project sort of this large, and I hadn't worked with an illustrator. But it was really wonderful to see how Sarah saw some of these scenes and these characters, even as I was writing them. And so she had a lot of input into, like, what would get illustrated and what wouldn't. And yeah, the conversations were really wonderful, and I can't imagine having written the book without Sarah's way of seeing these characters.
They add a lot to the experience of reading the book.
I'm glad. Yeah. I think they do too. I think like one of the things that the book is looking at or thinking about is and part of this is just the Gothic play, but it's, you know, it's acts of looking, right? It's like who's what character has sort of been a voyeur and has information that they shouldn't have, right? Or who's, you know, being watched and who's doing the watching. And so I think the illustrations just play with that. It's one more way of seeing this world and these characters. It's one more vantage point. So yeah, I'm really glad they're there. I can't again, I can't imagine the book without them.
It's a little bit unfair because this book isn't out yet. So like as somebody who has read the entire book cover to cover, like I have information that like I really shouldn't have at this point. So I mean, so it can take us off in a lot of different directions.
Sure.
But I'm trying to be so careful.
Yes. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. So Sarah was a fan of your first novel, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. Was it not made into a movie?
Here we go. It was it was made into a movie. Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Yep. What was that experience like for you?
It was really wonderful. It was Desiree Akvan and her writing partner, Cecilia Frugiuele. And I think because I had known Desi a little bit before they officially optioned the material and had a really clear sense of her vision for the story, mm-hmm. and knew that of this sort of long place-based coming-of-age story that she was really looking at adapting the final basically third of it. I knew that going in. And so knowing that, prepared me for seeing versions of the script, which they shared, and I got to give some notes, and I went to set. My wife and I are actually in the concert scene very briefly. I was not a good actor. my wife was I don't think that Desi likes it when I tell the story, but she came over at one point to kind of give us direction. It's very difficult, you know, when they film a music scene, probably a lot of people know this. You have to dance and there's no music in the background, right? So I'm already not a great dancer. And now we're dancing to this Christian rock band and there's no music playing. We're all pretending. They're pretending to play their instruments. We're pretending to dance. And she came over after one take. And there are other things going on in the scene that are much more important. And she came over after one take and said to my wife, "Erica, that was brilliant." And then she looked at me and then she walked away. And I was like, oh, no, I'm exactly as good an actor as I thought I was. So that was my experience. But I really, really, really love the film. And I think in terms of what I use, for Plain Bad Heroines to inform Plain Bad Heroines, it was really just the opportunity of being on set.
Right.
And seeing this thing that I thought that I knew, but I hadn't seen firsthand, which is just how collaborative a process filmmaking is. And
right.
I mean, I think you can know that, right? But hundreds of people have to come together to get something made, and they're all exerting their influence onto the thing being made.
Right.
And I think just having seen that in person was really instructive to me in a way that even as a film fan, right? I had never really gotten before.
Mm, yeah. And contrast that with your own experience as a novelist.
Which is so isolated, of course, right? Yeah. It's just me in my head or at my computer. And it's such a solitary practice. It's a little different with Sarah, which was fun to kind of open it up.
Yeah.
But even that, the composing and the creation is just so private. And I don't even really want to talk about it. I'm such a bummer when my family, I don't want to talk about the end of my writing day. Like if I'm really sort of into it, I just want to be into it and have it and keep it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the processes couldn't be more different, which is I think why I'm one of the reasons I've always been so interested in adaptation. And everything is adapted now, right? I mean, every novelist I know basically has their book optioned for something. And so we all have these stories. It felt like really ripe territory to explore.
When you're writing, if a family member dares to say something to you or ask a question, what happens?
If they ask a question like of me about something going on in the household or?
Yeah.
Oh, well, if they dare, they dare all the time. I am not at all scary. What are you talking about? My mother will sit down across from me and be like, so for dinner, are you doing and I'll kind of give a look. This is my own fault because I have a very nice desk in our basement and it really is a nice desk. And it's too overwhelming to write at. I think it's maybe a little bit too big. I thought it would be a really good idea, but I feel like I should be doing tax work or something,
mm-hmm.
I just don't know. Yeah. It really overwhelms me. So I end up writing at a corner of the dining room table, which is a common space. Again, my mom lives with my wife and I, and I just, they have to interact with me. I'm right there. So I'll kind of give a look. I do a look thing to kind of say, and sometimes I'll sigh and say, maybe not right now. But usually I just kind of huff like a seventh grader that's probably offensive to seventh graders. That's usually what I do though, is I huff and then I just answer whatever the question is. So. I love that you say if they dare though. No one in my household is at all afraid to kind of interrupt my writing. Pleased to do it.
So you live in Rhode Island
mm-hmm.
in a house, as we've mentioned. Is it at all haunted, or does it have some sort of strange spiritual past?
It does. Yeah, you've done your research. Yeah, it it was a lyceum at one point for the spiritual progressives in the area, and that's really what the building was built for. So the spiritual progressives are still around, not in this town, and certainly not in this building. But they were doing all kinds of. Essentially seances, and they would have spiritualists come and speak to the congregants. And there was much communing with the dead going on in this building. I have to say, I have never felt the presence of a ghostly sort of specter once in this building. I never have. I've lived in a lot of old buildings in my life, and I think that some of them I've, I'm not really a believer, but I felt like, oh, this is a little spooky. I just haven't here. But we do have a dog sitter who is convinced that the building is haunted and likes to tell me frequently that it is. So it's just not my experience. But I mean, obviously that what the kind of practices that were taking place here were instructive to me as I was thinking about Harold Burkhans, one of the characters in the novel, and some of the other spiritualists around him. So yeah, I'm sure some of it rubbed off, but I just don't think it's a particularly spooky building.
Sure. Have you been to a seance?
I have. But I think the whole thing was, I don't think that like it was conducted in the most serious manner. I would like to.
Oh, you went to a party seance.
I think, yes. Thank you. I've been to a party seance. That's exactly the right way to put it. Just as I've, played with a Ouija board many times. So yeah, I think that there are, I would like to sort of be in the presence of people that are not five beers in winging it maybe. So.
It's funny because I intend to, in the introduction to our conversation, call you the novelist, Emily.
Oh, wonderful.
The novelist. But do you at all identify as a journalist or a historian?
No.
No?
No.
No?
No, huh?
No.
Oh. No. Those seem like very grand terms, so no.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. No big deal. I can jump you into journalism right now.
Oh, like, thanks. Yeah. Wonderful.
You know,
wonderful.
You can get into the building on my pass,
okay.
Okay,
yeah. No idea.
It's just, this book is so rich with, and so much I like had to Google afterward and be like, is that type of apple real? Is Mary McLean a real person?
Oh, yeah.
And there are all of these cultural artifacts from all these different times. And it just like is a wealth, I would say. It's like a treasure chest full of these things. And like, you can tell that a lot of background research went into it.
Thank you. That's so delightful to hear. I think I've spoken to a couple of readers who were really convinced that I made Mary McLean up. And even when, because the book is so meta and there's so much winking about this line between what's real and what's not, they were convinced even, I mean, one was pretty convinced that like I made up her Wikipedia page. Like even when he found evidence of her, I'm like, I don't have those tech. I did not go that far. Like with the marketing team behind the book, she's a real person, but it took a while to convince him. And I think again, I did populate the book with things that, yeah, I'm thrilled to hear that they sort of fit the fictional world and maybe you wouldn't assume that they're real. Or I think probably a lot of readers are just taking for granted that I made them up. Like the black apples, which are a very real variety of apple that I still haven't seen in person. Black Oxfords. Spite Tower is based on a real location in Little Compton and it is called Spite Tower. So I twisted them and changed them to suit my purposes. But I think there are a lot of kind of Easter eggs like that throughout the book. And part of the years-long process of writing this book was just becoming really enamored with those cultural artifacts, as you put it. And I think I'm kind of like a magpie or something. I like to pick up shiny things and put them in the book. And yeah, this book is evidence of that. So,
How conscious are you when you're writing fiction of, are people going to buy into this?
Are they going to buy into? I think it depends on like what is happening on the page in a moment, right? I mean, I think that there are certain scenes where I'm very conscious, where I think I'm really thinking about, like, I need to make sure readers are with me. And there are other moments, I think, particularly with this narrator, who's doing a lot of winking, this kind of conspiratorial winking, where I maybe worried less about it. But there are certainly scenes where I hoped that readers were right there in the moment.
Well, I bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Wonderful.
Or Stinger. How about that? Hoopline and Stinger.
Oh, gosh. We're getting funny now.
I know. Well, you know what? I feel like I feel safe with you because I feel like we're cut from that same cloth.
Fair enough. You've established that I am not scary to approach, and you definitely can make puns in my presence. Absolutely.
I did have one other question that has been needling at me. Your name is written in lowercase font.
It Lions. Is. Yeah, I wish I had a better reason for this. I mean, this is inevitable. I just have, since a young age, really liked the way that it looks. I really like it's just that the small e. I've always preferred it, and I think there's something really. I always sound so dorky when I say this. There's something really nice about the look of the small e next to the small m to me. The way that those two play with each other, and so that's how I've written it since I was really young. And it makes no difference to me if anybody. Anybody else like heeds this, or I'm happy for it to be properly capitalized. But if I, you know, if someone asks, you know, or I get to do it myself, then I always write my name in lowercase. I always have.
You shall be lowercase in my
web
content, I assure you. And then one more question, a really pressing question for me is, there's another book in this book of books, and it's Answered Prayers by Truman Capote.
Yes.
What is it? What is this novel? What is it about it that you find obviously alluring?
Well, I think the thing that's most alluring to me about that book is it's sort of the legend around the book. And I think for Merritt too, it's that the first time I ever heard, and I was already a fan of Capote and had read, you know, quite a bit of his work. But the first time I heard about that book, it was like a group of writers talking about like, oh, that controversial book that Truman Capote never finished. And it was all the stories about, you know, and he published this chapter and then there were these sort of, you know, repercussions, and then he's on TV, you know, flouting them. And it was all that, this sort of big, there's this lore around it. And obviously I'm someone who's interested in lore. The Plain Bad Heroines is very interested in lore. So, I think that's really what it is. It's this idea of the unfinished book. And especially given what a self-promoter he was. And I think too, I mean, it would be wrong not to, it obviously plays with some of the themes of fame in the book and some of the other things going on, but I think it would be wrong not to say that part of my enchantment was that for a really long time, I thought that I would only ever write one novel because it was just taking me such a long time to write this book. And so I think I probably identified with like the person that would, you know, I'm not a self-promoter. I wasn't out there talking about my unfinished book, but I think I probably somewhere thought like, you won't ever finish this book either, you know? And so that's what this will be for you. Like I was kind of, you know, cursed by it. I'm sure that was part of my interest. It has to have been. I don't know. The book is really sort of delicious and catty, and it's really sad to me too. I think it's, I don't know. There's something so tantalizing about that book not being finished. Yeah. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Oh, well, one thing that is finished, it looks like, by my clock is our allotted time. So I just want to ask you if there's anything else you'd like our listeners to know about this book.
It goes on sale on October 20th. And
hey!
Other than that, no, that's it. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Emily, for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Thank you.
That was Emily M. Danforth, author of Plain Bad Heroines, out today from William Morrow. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week. That was Emily M. Danforth, author of Plain Bad Heroines, out today from William Morrow. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books for the week. We have Young Readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Starting with Vicki, what's your pick for the week?
Sorry, in looking at this book, I realized that it's not the sort of book that I should be trying to talk about on a podcast, just because I'm going to break up again the way I did with the dog book a few months ago.
Vicki!
It's a great book and people need to know about it, so I will do my best. It's called Addie's Cup of Sugar, and it's by John J. Muth, and it's part of his sequence of picture books about children and the wise panda Stillwater. And in these books, he brings, he sort of folds Buddhist teachings and Buddhist stories into stories about the panda and the children. And in this particular book, Addie, who's a little white girl, has just lost her kitten Trumpet in a car accident, and she is devastated. Hang on. And and so she goes to Stillwater to see if Stillwater, because Stillwater is just the wisest panda there is, to see if Stillwater can bring Trumpet back. And Stillwater says he'll make some special medicine, but she must get a cup of sugar. And the hitch is that she needs to find a cup of sugar from a house where death has been a stranger. And so she takes a cup and she goes through the neighborhood. Okay. And
we're here, take all the time.
And of course, every house she goes to, you know, one friend just lost a grandpa, another person has lost another family member, the school librarian's dog just died last week. And every single house she goes to, she realizes that everybody experiences death and everybody remembers their loved one who has passed, which she realizes, of course, is the medicine that Stillwater was going to make for her, was this understanding that death is something that happens to everybody, and that the memories of the departed are what, you know, help keep them alive. And the book is just gorgeous. John J. Muth makes his watercolors are just stunning. It's really, I think he's one of the best watercolorists doing children's books today. And, you know, every page is just gorgeous. You know, the Stillwater is enormous next to this little girl, but he's so fuzzy thanks to the sort of bleeding of the watercolor at the edges. And it's just a really, really lovely book and an important book for a lot of households, unfortunately.
Thank you for that, Vicki. My son was a big fan of Zen Shorts, so and I'm happy to say he seems to have a good interest in mindfulness and being present, which seems to be an important part of this book as well as addressing death, which is, of course, important. But do you have any other suggestions on books like mindfulness books that might be similar?
There have been a lot recently. Let me see. One that comes to mind is called Mindful Day. It's by Deborah Hopkinson, and it's illustrated by Shirley Ng Benitez. Mm-hmm. And it's good in the way that it sort of represents what a mindful day looks like. It's not so much instructive as sort of embed mindfulness into the plot.
That's perfect. Lovely.
Peter H. Reynolds and Susan Verdi have a book called I Am Peace, which is also has a mindfulness theme. It is a little bit more instructive about, you know, how to center yourself and stuff. And, you know, if Ace is interested, there's also a couple of neat kids biographies of Buddha, or of the Buddha, that have come out recently. One is called Where's Buddha by Marisa Aragon Ware, and the other is called The Life of the Buddha by Heather Sanche and illustrated by Tara DiGesu. I probably did not pronounce her name.
No, that's perfect. Anyway. Well, his dog is named Buddha, so that's very appropriate.
Are you kidding?
I'm not.
I have one more recommendation, if I can jump in. It's a book from 4 years ago called The Sound of Silence, mm-hmm. and it's by Katrina Goldseitel and illustrated by Julia Kuo. And it's about basically the idea of silence and in this kind of noise-filled world. But anyway, it's a great picture book.
Oh, I love that book. Thank you, Laura, for reminding us.
Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. Vicki, Laura, I often wish that you two were my librarians when I was young. I love how much we all love books, and the feeling is palpable. And thank you both for always coming correct with all of these really thoughtful suggestions. Vicki's pick of the week is Addie's Cup of Sugar by John J. Muth. Thank you very much for that pick. And now, of course, next, Laura, what have you chosen for us?
So I have something that will not make you cry. It's called Foreshadow Stories to Celebrate the Magic of Reading and Writing YA. And it's edited by Emily XR Pan and Nova Rensuma. And it emerged from this idea the two of them had. They're both, you know, very successful YA authors, and they wanted to kind of mentor and showcase aspiring writers from underrepresented groups. So what they did was they invited a number of like big names in the YA world to look over these entries, these short stories, and select 13 that are in this collection. But it's not just an anthology, which is great for, you know, pandemic brain, shorter, you know, attention spans. It's also, so many people right now are working on their own writing. This book doesn't just present great stories. It also has a brief intro explaining why the famous author picked this story. And then at the end, Pan and Suma take turns highlighting a writing technique that the story exemplifies. So it also, it can help you be a better writer if that's what you want, or it could just help you be a better reader because it kind of shows you what to pay attention to. It's mostly speculative fiction. So here's one example. There's a story called Princess by Maya Prasad, and Cynthia Leitik Smith chose it, and she writes this little intro saying, "In Princess, the voice and the pacing are irresistibly compelling, the world fully rendered. Moreover, the story offers a thoughtful, near-futuristic take on an eternally pressing thematic question, what makes us human and why?" So you get to enjoy this great science fiction story. And then Emily Pan writes about world building in the story and how important world building is and how it applies, you know, across genres. And then there's story prompt fleshing out the world with several points that you can use to consider your own writing or other books you read. So it's just a really creative and unusual anthology that I think is widely applicable for adults as well as teens.
This sounds so great, Laura. I'm going to get it for my son, who's taking AP English right now. And over the summer, he had to read this book, How to Read Literature Like a Professor, which I think a lot of people like it, but I started reading it and I found it sort of super dry. I don't want to totally diss the book, but, you know, it's all about looking for symbols and metaphors, which I guess, you know, it's useful for students who've never thought about books this way, but this book looks like a much more creative way to get kids to look at what's happening in a story and how to think about what the author is doing in a story. So I like the looks of this. I'm going to get it for him.
Oh, great. Yeah, I want to hear what he thinks. It's definitely not dry, I'll say.
Laura's pick for the week is Foreshadow, Stories to Celebrate the Magic of Reading and Writing YA, edited by Emily XR Pan and Nova Rensuma. Thank you, Laura, for that choice. Next, we have nonfiction with Eric. Eric, what's your choice?
Well, speaking of not dry, I have the memoir from Mariah Carey.
Yes!
Called, I'm going to be honest, I hate the title. It's called The Meaning of Mariah Carey. And I'm going to be honest again, I'm not really a fan, but...
How dare you?
I know. Our reviewer is very much a fan, and he's actually been a DJ for years. And Mariah has always been a big part of his rotation. And it's just a really good, it's pretty much a straightforward memoir, but there's a lot of good stuff about her biracial upbringing. She had a black father and an Irish Catholic mother who was also an opera singer, but she had to deal with a lot of emotional trauma, physical violence, and of course, a lot of racial prejudice growing up in the 70s and 80s. And then also she's very candid about her really abusive marriage that she had to Tommy Mottola, who was the head of Columbia Records at the time when he signed her when she was 18. And so from there, kind of the arc of her career as she becomes a star. And she also does a lot of interesting stuff about her influences, Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin being two main ones. And for any fan, her lambs, as her fans call themselves, which I didn't know, it's just an absolutely quite revealing, candid portrait, and our a reviewer's last line is great. It says, 100% Mariah, unburdened by filler material and written with pure heart and soul for both diehard and casual fans. So I think this is going to be a huge bestseller. And well, it's already on the list, but I think it's going to be on there for a while. And anybody who's a fan of her or, you know, that period in pop history will find a lot to like here.
Yeah. Eric, Mariah Carey has been a force for so long that there are probably a wide range of fans. And yes. I would like to let folks know about a book for younger Mariah Carey fans. It's a really sweet book that came out a few years ago. It's called The Sweetest Sound by Sherry Winston. And the main character is an African-American girl. Her name is Cadence Mariah Jolly. And the Mariah is explicitly after Mariah Carey. Mariah Carey is sort of her idol. And like Mariah Carey, Cadence is a very talented singer, but nobody knows because she's got this incredibly sort of crushing anxiety about performance. And the story, I mean, it's not 100% focused on Mariah Carey at all, but the whole idea of singing and finding your truth through singing and becoming brave enough to become a performer, that those are the themes of the book. And it's a really sweet book. I think that if there are households with younger Mariah Carey fans out there, they might be interested in The Sweetest Sound.
That's great. Thank you for that.
Eric's pick for the week is The Meaning of Mariah Carey by Mariah Carey. Thank you, Eric, for that pick. And I totally agree with you about the title. I would even prefer it if it was just The Meaning of Mariah, because like,
yeah, that would be first, better.
Yeah, first diva rule is you only need one name.
One name, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, Cher, Aretha, you know, like, come on. So, you know, maybe in the paperback.
I'll anyway, talk to the thank publisher, you. Yeah.
Thank you for that public service.
Sure.
And thank you for your pick. Finally, we have Fiction with Lori. Lori, what's your choice for us?
I've got a great book, The Searcher by Tana French.
Oh, did you interview her?
I did interview her, which was super exciting. It's like,
so
you know,
cool.
The one good thing about quarantining at home is, you know, being able to talk to writers no matter where they are. I mean, I guess there used to be the telephone, but now everybody's so used to, you know, talking on Zoom or whatever. So I did get to talk to her from her house in Dublin, which was really fun.
So cool.
She was very, very nice. You know, I am one of these people who, you know, waits in anticipation for the next Tana French book. She, you know, unlike most mystery writers, she only writes them every few years, not like once a year. And this book is her second standalone in a row. It's not part of her Dublin Murder Squad series that were her popular first number of books. And this one is also different from any of her other books in that it's written in the third person. It doesn't have a first person narrator, which, you know, might seem like a kind of book critic-y thing to think about, but it really gives it a different feeling. All of her books are so interior. They're like in the detective's head, you know, seeing things from their perspective. And this, you know, is told from an omniscient point of view, even though it kind of follows closely the guy who's sort of the detective. And I asked her why she decided to do that. And she said she wanted to try a book that was about a main character who was more a person of action, you know, not like a ruminator, like many of her other detectives. So she wanted to see what that was like. So this book follows a guy named Cal, who is an American detective who has just retired after 30 years on the force. His wife has left him. It's kind of, you don't really find out for a long time what was going on, but he's just moved to the west of Ireland. He's not even Irish American, but he just wants a sort of quiet life to get away from everything. So of course, you know, within weeks of his being in this tiny town in the west of Ireland, a neighborhood kid starts kind of hanging around and insinuating into Cal's life. And it turns out the kid has, you know, a mystery that he wants Cal to examine. His brother went missing some time ago and nobody knows where the brother is. Everybody's saying, oh, he just ran off to London or something like so many people do. But the kid is just sure that something terrible has happened to his brother. So, of course, Cal poking into this reluctantly stirs up a hornet's nest, as you would expect in this tiny town in the west of Ireland. And we follow and see what happens. And it's just, you know, it's so much about learning what's how the town works and who all the people are. And even though French was kind of wanting more action, it's not like an action-packed mystery novel at all. It is actually kind of slow-paced and things unfold, and it's a real sort of enjoyable reading experience.
Laurie, when you introduced the book, I was thinking, and the author, I was thinking, the only thing I don't like about Tanya French is she doesn't write as fast as I'd like her to. I've never met one of her books I didn't like, but it's like, oh, I have to wait so long. But it was interesting because I noticed, I was looking at the reviews of her books, and a lot of them did talk about, you know, the relatively slow pace and so on. But I think even though I often like plot-driven stories, the mood or the feeling, the sense of place is just so rich, and it really, sometimes I'll forget exactly what happened, but I can still remember the mood of each of the books. And I wanted to recommend for people who are, you know, in between waiting for her next book, if you don't know Denise Mina, she writes these fantastic Glaswegian story mysteries that are just fantastic as well. So
yeah, I've read her new one sitting right here. I was thinking about, I haven't read one of her books in years, but I was thinking about trying that. The other thing that she told me, Tana French told me when I spoke to her, is that what she had in mind when she wrote this book is that she'd been reading a lot of Westerns, and she kind of was thinking, oh, you know, the West of the United States has things in common with the West of Ireland. What if I wrote a sort of Western, you know, a stranger comes to town kind of thing? So that was in the back of her mind, too.
Very interesting.
Laurie's pick for the week is The Searcher by Tana French. And don't forget to check out her very cool interview with Tana French in the latest issue of Kirkus. Thank you, Laurie, for that choice. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. Please join us again next week when my guest will be Alicia Garza, one of the co-creators of Black Lives Matter, along with Patrice Cullors and Opal Tometi. She's an organizer and political strategist, and her new book is called The Purpose of Power: How We Come Together When We Fall Apart. You won't want to miss that one. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.